Okay, so our next speaker is Eric Thomas.
Hello. Okay.
And his microphone works. And his title is Steering, Predictability, and Other Concepts of Experimental Metaphysics.
Thank you. First, I'd like to say that this has been one of the most interesting conferences I've ever been to, and it's just the first day so far, so I'm really excited, and I hope it's going to still have lots of interesting talks. And also, the roundtable discussion yesterday was quite interesting, and part of my talk, my title, will remind you of one of the discussions we had about this interface between physics and philosophy. And one of the feuds, if you might even call that a feud, that better describes this interface is this thing that Evan and Shimony called experimental metaphysics. Maybe the physicists might not like it because of the metaphysics in the term, and the philosophers might not like it because of the experimental in the term. So maybe no one's going to like it after all. But I find it a very interesting thing. And Evan and Shimony used that to describe the EPR Bell kind of experiments. But what I want to argue today is that there's much more to experimental metaphysics than just Bell's theorem. And to think in that kind of way might still be very useful to both physics and philosophy, because some concepts that were once thought to be metaphysical might, after all, have some experimental consequences, and to physics because forcing physicists to be explicit about their concepts will, I believe, help getting new theories. All right. So the model that I'm going to use to derive these things in my talk is what some people call ontological and ontological model. Many people use this term for a very similar thing, although you might have different emphasis on the assumptions that go into an ontological model. And particularly, I want to try to be explicit about what realism is supposed to mean in local realism. There is a paper from Travis Norsen who argues that there's no such a thing as this thing called realism in local realism. And I think that's not right. I think there is something which stands for this realism. At least there's a minimal thing which people probably will agree that's what they mean by this realism. And that's probably not what philosophers call realism, so maybe philosophers will disagree entirely about what I'm going to describe as being realism. But I think that's what physicists mean when they use that term. And Einstein had this quote, and that's probably for me what describes better what this realism is supposed to mean. If one asks what is irrespective of quantum mechanics is characteristic of the world of ideas of physics, one is first of all struck by the following. The concepts of physics relate to a real outside world. It is further characteristic of these physical objects that they are thought of as arranged in a space-time continuum. An essential aspect of this arrangement of things in physics is that they lay claim at a certain time to an existence independent of one another, provided these objects are situated in different parts of space. So, of course, in relativity, the concept of object is not very well defined, especially if you want to say that they're situated in different parts of space. So you want, in the end of the day, in the limit, you want to have concepts of events. So what you want to say really, what I think this axiom, this first axiom of reality means is that events happen independently of observers or frames of reference. Events are real things out there, and regardless of any frame of reference of any observer, everybody will agree that this cup hit the table at a certain... Well, different people will disagree on when and where that happened, but everybody will agree that a cup hit a table. That event happened. And the other thing is that these events, these things which are out there, independent of observers or frames of reference, they can be embedded as points in a single relativistic space-time. And it's important that it's a single one. And I think that's something to emphasize. And then you can apply concepts of space-time separation, light cones, and etc. Now, Bell always emphasized that his concept of local causality was distinct. Oh, I skipped. Oh, so what's happening? Okay, too sensitive. So Bell always emphasized that his concept of local causality was distinct from that of signal locality, which many people take to be the actual consequence of relativity. And the reason for that is that he thinks that signal locality is too anthropocentric. You need fundamentally to talk about controllable things, uncontrollable things, to talk about information. So let's see one of his quotes. Suppose we are finally obliged to accept the existence of these correlations at long range. Can we then signal faster than light? To answer this, we need at least a schematic theory of what we can do, a fragment of a theory of human beings. Suppose we can control variables like A and B above, A and B meaning some settings of experiments in a Bell, EPR Bell experiment, but not those like capital A and capital B, which are the outcomes. I do not quite know what like means here, but suppose the beables, and here he uses some beables for what I prefer to call events, or real things out there, somehow fall into two classes, controllables and uncontrollables. The latter are no use for sending signals, but can be used for reception. So then he rejects that idea that signal locality is the fundamental limitation imposed by relativity. Do we have to fall back on no signaling faster than light as the expression of the fundamental causal structure of contemporary theoretical physics? This is hard for me to accept. For one thing, we have lost the idea that correlations can be explained, or at least this idea awaits reformulation. More importantly, the no signaling notion rests on concepts which are desperately vague or vaguely applicable. The assertion that we cannot signal faster than light immediately provokes the question, who do we think we are? We who can make measurements, we who can manipulate external fields, we who can signal at all, even if not faster than light. Do we include chemists, only physicists, plants, or only animals, pocket calculators, or only mainframe computers? Can I have some more here? So he wanted to distance his notion of local causality from that of signal locality. And everybody knows that they are not the same thing. But the fact that local causality is violated in nature and signal locality is not led many people to think that, well, but signal locality maybe is really the fundamental thing that relativity is telling us. So if that's the case, then we need to say, then we need to include a schematic theory of what we can do. That's, if signal locality is fundamental, then, and it is about transferring information about controlling something here and changing something there, then that, well, what he said is just right. We need a schematic theory of what we can do. So the ontological model has fundamentally in it observers, and there are variables which the observers can control, can set, and there are variables which they can observe. So the basic definitions here, we have LSI. Do we have a point? Laser pointer. This pen, okay. Found it. Right. So Alice and Bob are two spatially separated observers. They can choose settings, little a, little b, and the outcomes are capital A and capital B. They have prepared this pair of systems with a reproducible procedure, little c. And all of these events, all of these things here, correspond to real events in that sense that I meant by axiom one. And these region here is basically like separated from that. And lambda represent any further variables which might be relevant to the outcomes of the measurements considered. I want to stress here that in the notation I'm using, it's important that C represents all those things that we know about experiment, and lambda represents all those things that we don't know. So the distinction is really epistemic between those. But they are both meant to be real. So ontologically, they are on the same footing. They are both real events, or at least the lambda possible real things out there. Whether or not they actually exist is a question we try to answer with respect to different assumptions we don't have. But the distinction can only be a distinction, an epistemic distinction. I know about the preparation, but I don't know about the variables. That's all. So there's something weird. I just click once and it flips twice. So we define a phenomenon. There's going to be a bunch of definitions, and please just bear with me to get the conclusions clearly. It's important to define things carefully. A phenomenon is defined by the relative frequencies of the observed outcomes. So the Bayesians out there will shiver now with that. But that's just a definition of phenomenon. That doesn't mean, it is Bayesian. But that's just a definition of phenomenon. You can't imagine that that's not probability. That's just frequency. The phenomenon is defined by the frequencies. But that you might believe there is something else which is called probability, and that's not frequency. That's fine. We're going to need then an extra axiom, which is this external conditionalization or free will or with relation to some of the talks here, no backwards causality, that the hidden variables are independent of the future choice of experiments. So with that, then an ontological model is just a set of values for the hidden variables together with some probability distribution for the hidden variables given the preparation procedure, and a specification of the probabilities, the joint probabilities of the outcomes given all those things, which correctly predicts the phenomenon.
So,
yeah. 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 Well, there could be some of these lambdas, which they are causally dependent on the preparation procedure, but you don't know about them. But knowing the preparation procedure, you might have to gain some information about them. That's.
I guess it's a question. It is a bit curious why you put C in the position you put it.
Right. Well, actually, I didn't. That was Bell. I got that from one of Bell's papers.
Right.
Yeah. Actually, I agree. It should be around here, right? Is that what you mean?
It should be in the comments.
Should be, of course, yes. Yeah, I agree. It's good that you noticed that. I also thought it was weird, but it should be down here. Was that the question? Or?
Yeah, it's related. I'm still trying to puzzle it out because it seems to depend also that C can depend on lambda. Or, I don't think that's what you mean, but the way it's represented, it looks like that. In other words, there's a mutual dependence between lambda and C.
Yes.
You really want, you don't want to have, you want to have the choice, the preparation procedure be free. You want C to be free, is that correct?
Sure, but it may cause it may have some effect on some hidden variables, which will be some variables which you don't know about, which will be relevant to the outcomes of experiment in the future.
Sure.
That's the only difference between lambda and C is what you know.
Yeah.
Otherwise, no other difference.
Yeah. The things that you know might give you some hints about the things you don't know.
And C is going to be fixed throughout, so you don't have to worry about.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Even if you think that this should be independent, lambda should be independent of C, all the conclusions won't change.
Well, I'm more worried about C being independent of lambda, but
it's not going to change anyway.
It's not going to change anyway. That exactly. It's just that that's a lot of possibility that they are. If they are not, that's even worse.
So you did say a Bayesian.
What is the problem?
Because the relative frequencies will change from one realization of the entire thing to another, and they won't always be exactly equal to that combination of properties. So that would be right, the P on the right. And so do you have any problem with putting a P on the right in place of that?
Sorry, say it again.
So that equation isn't even right.
Why? Well, what do you mean? It's just a model. Like, I'm trying to imagine that.
No. It's the equality that's the problem. If we say
approximately
equal to.
Right. Okay, good. Yes, I agree. So you could put it approximately equal. That'd be good enough.
The probabilities?
Huh?
A phenomenon is described by the probabilities and not the relative frequencies. What's the problem then?
Because the phenomenon is what you observe, and you observe relative frequencies. You don't observe probabilities. Probabilities are your knowledge, and you don't observe them. You have them in yourself. So, of course, you can only observe approximately that the relative frequencies correspond to your state of knowledge. That's why I agree this should be an approximate thing.
But an arbitrarily good approximation.
Arbitrarily good approximation. Okay, so an operational theory is the class of trivial models, the class of models which I didn't do anything. The class of models for which the probabilities do not depend on the hidden variables. So they can reproduce the frequencies approximately, if you want, without taking into account any things you don't know. And a hidden variable model is any model, therefore, that is not trivial. So you can find a bunch of notions of locality. First is the local causality is the one that Bell actually missed. That's Bell locality. And that means that the probabilities of outcomes here do not depend on any events that happen over there. You can have other notions of locality. Then you can have this notion of locality of what Shimony called parameter independence, which is just that the outcomes do not depend on the choice. And you don't talk about whether or not they depend on the outcome. Another notion that we could call causality, the names, maybe you don't want to read them, but that's okay, it's just definitions. So you may prefer these two because they are sort of they're very specific. They're not used for anything else apart from that. So outcome independence is then when the probabilities of the outcomes do not depend on the outcome on the other side, but they might depend on the choice. And a phenomenon. Now, these things are things that correspond to models. These are properties of models, possible properties of models. And a phenomenon can satisfy signal locality when the frequencies on one side do not depend on the choice on the other side. If they did, you could use that to send signals. So, and determinism then is a property of a model. You can say that a model is deterministic when those probabilities there are 0, 1, or when these things here are functions of all the settings in of the hidden variables. But it's important to distinguish determinism from predictability. Determinism is an ontological concept, and predictability is an epistemic concept. So, predictability is when a phenomenon is deterministic, and what's more, it's trivial. You don't need a hidden variable and to have probability 0 and 1. With all the things you know, the probabilities are already 0 and 1. A model is going to be said to be locally deterministic when it satisfies both locality, and not local causality, I mean locality, and determinism. And just a few more definitions. A model is going to be said to violate some property if it lacks a property. An operational theory violates a property if all trivial models violate the property. A phenomenon violates a certain property if all models violate the property. You cannot find any model which has that property. And nature violates some of the property if a phenomenon that violates that is observed. And I didn't need to change it. Change again.
Is it circular slingshot?
Huh?
Are you running your
Yes, it is PowerPoint.
Oh, no, as a slideshow.
As a slideshow? No. Well, I didn't. Oh, it might be using my timings for rehearsal, but I don't know how to turn it off. Too late. I have to.
Never rehearse.
Never rehearse.
Play again. Natty rehearsal.
Back. too much back.
We know what they look like.
Yeah. Right. So the two main things that I want to say today will both relate to the famous Einstein-Bohr debate. So I'll first start with the second part of the Einstein-Bohr debate, which is when Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen came with their argument for incompleteness. So everybody knows their argument, and
maybe you should turn off PowerPoint and just click through this line. You know, turn off this full screen view and then just do it like you're editing and just click through it, and then it'll at least be controlled.
Turn off the full. All right, I see. But it's so annoying. I don't like to see all the things around. I prefer to be annoyed by this than by all the clutter around.
Perhaps this as pauses the slideshow, and you can.
It does. Spacebar.
Well,
no, it just. It didn't. All right. Stop it there. Next second. Now this is really annoying. I think maybe going to the smaller view is better than this. Sorry, can I just see if I can somehow tell it to not use the times? Oh well, anyway. Here it is. So. No, sorry, I'll use it then. Press function in page. Right. So the argument everybody knows is just that if they find an incompatibility between these assumptions of completeness of quantum mechanics, certain sufficient condition for reality they have, these underlying assumption of local causality, and some predictions of quantum mechanics, because they believe that these last three were totally true, they took that to be an argument for the incompleteness of quantum mechanics. First thing I want to say is that you can formalize that in or at least those two assumptions of local causality and completeness in a more precise way. And it's very simple. It's just this: local causality implies that factorizability of the joint probabilities, and completeness, I want to argue, is just implies that the probabilities for Bob's system must be compatible with some quantum state. If they were not compatible with some quantum state, then that would mean that if you knew about those hidden variables there, you could predict more than what quantum mechanics allows you to. That's just what it means to say that quantum mechanics is incomplete. So if it is complete, then the probabilities conditioned on the hidden variables on the Bob side must be compatible with some quantum state. They could not pin down the probability is better than some quantum state can allow you to. So if you just put those things together, you just get separability. And so that what that means is that any demonstration of non-separability is a demonstration of the failure of these two assumptions, local causality and completeness. But Schrödinger, in a reply to EPR, he came up with this notion of steering, which he was puzzled by the fact that by a choice of experiment here, Alice could change the quantum state of Bob over there. And Howard Wiseman and Steve Jones and Andrew Doherty wrote this paper on Carol recently, where they formalized this notion of steering that Schrödinger introduced. And it was by the failure of this thing they call the local hidden state model, which is where, in one side, Bob's probabilities are described by some quantum system, some quantum state, but you leave Alice's probabilities unconstrained. Saying that they can be given by a hidden variable is not being, it's not making any assumption. It's quite the opposite. It's the lack of an assumption. To say that Bob's probabilities are a quantum state, that's an assumption, because that pins down the space of possibilities for what these probabilities can be. To say that they are given by a hidden variable just doesn't pin down anything at all. Just leave that free. So if you just wanted to demonstrate incompatibility between local causality and completeness, we had some discussions about this with Rob in the last conference, then I would agree that the most accurate way to do that is just with non-separability. But the local hidden state model is the best way to represent this asymmetric argument that EPR and Schrödinger, trying to formalize what EPR was doing, actually used. And that is then the most general way to demonstrate that my choices here can affect the state over there, if you want to assume that the state over there is a quantum state and it's a real local property of the system. And if you want to demonstrate that experimentally, then you're going to need something like steering criteria. In general, the you can derive some criteria from that assumption, analogous to what you do with Bell and Pauli's, and that's what Steve's going to talk next. But I would say that it is not an argument for incompleteness. It sounds a bit paradoxical. That may depend on what you mean, what you think this first argument tells you. But I say that it's not an argument for incompleteness, because local causality is violated anyway. So violation of this conjunction of local causality and completeness cannot be used as an argument for incompleteness.
In hindsight.
Oh, and these are things which I figured out that I wouldn't have time to talk, so please ignore the green things. Now, to the next thing, which is about predictability. First, some general results regarding that. Predictability is strictly stronger than intelligence. I think that's pretty obvious. Any predictable phenomenon must have a deterministic model, but the other way around is not necessarily true. You can have an unpredictable phenomenon, which is as an underlying deterministic model. And a trivial case is just if you ignore some variables. And another case is, for example, Bohmian mechanics. It's deterministic in the bottom, but you can't have predictability. There's a fundamental reason why you can't have predictability. Some phenomena violate predictability. That's a trivial statement as well. You just ignore some relevant variables, and there you have it. But, and this is an interesting thing, no phenomenon violates determinism. You can always find some deterministic model for any phenomenon you can see. So in a sense, that makes determinism a really metaphysical concept.
Why doesn't it make it trivial?
Huh?
Doesn't it make it trivial?
It does.
Okay, and so you equate metaphysical concept with triviality?
Well, that's exactly what I'm saying. Predictability is an interesting concept because it's not trivial. Determinism isn't because it's trivial.
Well, but I think it's only trivial when you apply it to phenomena.
Of course, when I apply it to phenomena, exactly. But yeah, in the sense that I take that back. It's not uninteresting. It's not uninteresting. But if you want to say I want to find a phenomenon for which I know for sure that determinism is false, you can't do that. That's what I'm trying to say. You can always fit some model which will be deterministic. You can always have the future be some function of the past. There is always some complicated function in which the future is a function of the past. So in that sense, you can't have a phenomenon violate determinism, but you can have a phenomenon violate predictability. All right, some other... So how much time do I have?
So you should be finishing at 2:30. It's allowed time for questions, but I'll give you a bit more time if you can do it.
Yeah, so that means 20 minutes.
That means 20, yeah.
Yeah, okay, good. So some other definitions now that we go into some quantum results. First, orthodox quantum theory or operational quantum theory is an operational theory in which reproduces quantum mechanics, which agrees with quantum mechanics in a standard way. And a quantum model is any model whose predictions agree with quantum mechanics. And a quantum phenomenon, of course, is a phenomenon that is predicted by operational quantum theory. Then we finally get to Bell's theorem. First, Bell theorem was a proof that all deterministic quantum models violate locality. At first, he considered local deterministic models. And the notion of locality here is not exactly the notion of local causality that Bell came up with later. It's that stronger notion which, conditioned on the hidden variables, the probabilities over there don't depend on your choices here. But that's equivalent to a later version of Bell's theorem, which says that quantum phenomena violate local causality. But that was really just a bit later that was recognized. And the fact that many experiments since then demonstrate a violation of Bell's inequalities then allows us to conclude that nature violates local causality and local determinism. Now, what about predictability? So, of course, we all know that operational quantum theory violates determinism. Operational quantum theory, mind you, is just this model in which there are no hidden variables. It's just really the things we know. Then, of course, that violates determinism. And if it violates determinism, of course, then it violates predictability. You can't have predictability without determinism. But you can have the other way around. And, of course, quantum phenomena violate predictability. The phenomena in themselves, because the phenomena are described by just what you know, well, and what you observe, the phenomena in themselves, they are unpredictable. That's not to say, though, that they are irreducibly unpredictable, that they are fundamentally unpredictable. There is no way in which you could know something more such that you would be able to predict things. That, of course, is a theorem of quantum mechanics, but and that's just a statement of Heisenberg's standard principle. But that's a model-dependent statement. You can make that statement within quantum mechanics. If you assume that observables correspond to through outcomes of observables correspond to predictors in Hilbert space, and you assume Born's probability rule, and that states vectors in a Hilbert space for density matrices, then you can derive the fact that quantum phenomena are irreducibly unpredictable. But can you give some other argument by which they should be reducibly unpredictable, independent of the rest of the formalism of quantum mechanics? And that was the first part of Einstein-Bohr debate. Before trying to get to argue for the incompleteness of quantum mechanics, Einstein tried to actually show that quantum mechanics was empirically false, that you could violate a certain principle, you could actually get more information about quantum phenomena and have them be more predictable than quantum mechanics allows you to. So in those debates, Bohr always won. I always came up with a way by which he could block Einstein's argument. And the way he did that was that he consistently applied the uncertainty principle to both the system that they were trying to measure and the apparatus that was measuring the system. Einstein was ignoring that the uncertainty principle should also apply to the apparatus. And then he got to the conclusion that he could violate the uncertainty principle. So Bohr said, no, if you apply the whole thing consistently, then there's no problem. You can't violate the uncertainty principle. But of course, that just tells you that that the whole thing is consistent. That if an uncertainty principle is valid for everything, then it's valid for everything. But that's almost a trivial statement. Could Bohr give a better argument to Einstein and to convince him that goal of having predictability is definitely impossible? And of course, by just observation of one phenomena, you can't say that, because you can't necessarily know that you can't know that there is nothing else there that you don't know that could allow you to have predictability. So is there anything we can say in a sort of a model independent way about predictability? So first thing I like to talk about is one of my favorite paradoxes, which is Newcomb's paradox. It has nothing to do with quantum mechanics, but it's sort of an aside. It is this paradox in which there is a guy who says he's a predictor. He can tell exactly what your actions are going to be, what you're going to choose. And he has two boxes in front of you. One has $1,000, and you can see there's $1,000 there. And the other, he tells you, has either $1,000,000 or nothing. If he predicted yesterday that you were going to pick just this one box, then he says he would have put $1,000,000. If he predicted that you were going to pick both, then he put nothing. So he gives you this choice. Do you want to pick just one, or do you want to pick both? So there's an interesting paradox in itself, but that's the paradox in itself is relevant to what I'm going to say. It's just that I like it, so I put it there. There's also a little argument that, a little analogy that can be done between that and the situation involving violations of Bell inequalities. Again, make sort of an analogy between the assumptions that go into there. Because there's a certain attempt of solving this paradox, which is by something called a causal decision theory. And you can make a parallel that having this causal decision theory is the same as assuming fiercely local realism in quantum mechanics. So if you would assume that, then you would never bet on the violation of Bell inequalities, no matter how many times you saw it. So, but anyway, but that's irrelevant. The relevant thing is this. So what? Let's start to think of the possibility of this predictor. Suppose this predictor actually exists, and he can predict what you're going to do. At first you would say, no, that's impossible. I like coffee and I hate tea. So if you see me going to get some to a table to get either coffee or tea, you can predict certainly that I'm going to get coffee. You're always going to get it right. But if you go and tell me, Eric, I know you're going to get coffee, of course I'm going to say, aha, no, I've got tea, just to prove you wrong. So that may make you feel that this predictability really is impossible. But it's not. It's consistent that it could be like this. This predictor does exist, and the thing that's going on is deterministic. And he knows that I'm going to get coffee. But in the end, he knows that if he told me that I was going to get coffee, I would get tea. But he cannot tell me that, because of the very structure of myself, which says, if someone told me that if I was going to get coffee, then I'm going to get tea. He knows that. And he knows that if he tells me, I won't get tea. I won't get coffee. I'll get tea. Yet, the whole thing, the underlying is deterministic, and I can even understand why he can tell me. So it's completely there's a whole completely consistent story that can be told that makes then this predictability be fundamentally incommunicable because of the structure of the system, which is me, which would behave differently if the system were informed of the prediction. But that has nothing to do with quantum mechanics. Now, this is where the animation would have come handy. But this has something to do with quantum mechanics. How can you turn an unpredictable phenomenon into a predictable one? So imagine again that situation of that we are discussing in the ontological models. And you want to imagine that. You want to ask the question, is there a predictable, is there a possibility of having a predictable phenomenon underlying this unpredictable phenomenon that I'm seeing? So in general, you can always describe the things you're seeing in an ontological model like that. And if you want to imagine the possibility that it can be predictable, then you must have some underlying deterministic model, something like that. Maybe you don't know the hidden variables, but underlying the whole thing is deterministic. And maybe you imagine, oh well, if I knew the hidden variables, then I would be able to predict things, right? The whole thing is deterministic there. So what stops me from just getting access to those hidden variables and predicting what's going to happen? Yeah.
You want to try doing this bit with the slide show, just so it's clearer what's.
I will. Okay, so starting again. So you have this phenomenon that is unpredictable, because remember, the definition of predictability depends on what you know. The definition of predictability depends on what you know. But you could imagine that maybe if you knew a bit more, if you knew about hidden variables, then you could have predictability. If you even want to consider that possibility, then you need to consider the possibility that the underlying phenomenon is deterministic. You don't know about it, you don't know hidden variables, but it's deterministic. And maybe I could know about it. So you imagine that you go there and you sneak a peek, and you turn the hidden variables into known variables. And I'll just change the letters to represent it. Now you know about them. So instead of being lambda here, just change to C prime. It's just another part of your preparation. Now, it's just something else that you know. But if this was deterministic, now this phenomenon is going to be predictable, because you know everything here, and these probabilities are 0, 1, so there you go, it's predictable. But if you assume relativistic invariance, then signal locality must be valid. If signal locality was invalid in relativity, then you could use that to create a sort of a time causal loop paradox. You have two boxes here which can communicate fast and light with each other. This one sends a signal to that. But if there's no preferred reference frame, then maybe there's another reference frame in which, like this here, I hope you can understand what I mean, this is space and this is time. There's another reference frame in which there is two boxes here, and this one can send a signal to that one. But this one is in the future of this, and this one is in the past of that. So you can create a causal loop in which I will only send a signal if I don't receive a signal from there, and here I will only send a signal if I receive a signal from that. So you create a sort of a time travel paradox. So signal locality is a very strong assumption, because violation of that in relativity actually leads you to a paradox, as opposed to violation of local causality, which by itself doesn't give you any paradox. We actually do violate local causality, and so we should assume that we can't get any paradox from that, otherwise we would be seeing contradictions in the labs these days. But that's not what we see. We just see some things we can't explain. It's not exactly a contradiction. But signal locality is stronger. It would actually lead you to a contradiction, unless there's some sort of something that prevents you from choosing what you want, and something that prevents a free will or something like that. Then you would have some contradictions. But if we get this unpredictable predictor model from these underlying presumed deterministic phenomena, and signal locality is valid, that translates in the original deterministic model to a locality condition, to a parameter independence. If you could know about the hidden variables such that you turn this underlying deterministic model into a predictable model, then signal locality tells you that if that's the case, then the underlying model, the deterministic model, must be local. But that's exactly what Bell inequalities prohibit you from having. Violation of Bell's inequalities rule out all local deterministic models. So if they rule out all local deterministic models, then you can't have this predictability either for this particular phenomenon. So that means, if you rule out all the, if you observe a phenomenon that rules out all local deterministic models, that's what we mean by saying that nature violates local causality. So you can also say that nature is reducibly unpredictable. This phenomenon we observe with an assumption of signal locality, which I will assume that is a very strong assumption, leads you to this inevitable conclusion that there are phenomena in nature which you cannot know more about. And that's dependent on quantum mechanics. It's not because Heisenberg's principle tells you to, it's just because otherwise you would get to a contradiction. You'd get a paradox. So how much time do we still have?
Say 10 minutes.
Okay. So maybe I should go back to this. Right, what does it mean? So signal locality implies that any phenomena that violates Bell's inequalities are fundamentally unpredictable. And since we observe those phenomena modulo some loopholes, then nature is fundamentally unpredictable. And that's not just a corollary of Bell's theorem. You might think, wait a minute, but the Bell theorem says local determinism is not possible. So if you assume locality, then determinism is not possible, therefore predictability is not possible. But no, that's a wrong conclusion, because determinism is possible. It is possible to have a model which is deterministic and does violate local causality. Because local causality doesn't lead you to any violation of local causality by itself, doesn't lead you to any paradoxes. Bohmian mechanics violates local causality and, it just reproduces quantum mechanics, and that's fine. But violation of signal locality is something that's pretty strong. So it's not directly a corollary of Bell's theorem. You need to make this distinction between determinism and predictability, and this distinction between signal locality and just Bell locality, to get to this new passing of Bell's theorem. And it has some implications for a bit for everyone. First for Bohmians, because a common question that I've seen some people ask, an objection against Bohmian mechanics is this. If this model is deterministic, why can't I know about any variables? And the answer is just this. Well, because if you could, then you would violate signal locality. According to relativity, that would lead you to some paradoxes. Another thing that maybe Rob might find interesting is that it puts a fundamental epistemic constraint on nature based on the strong notion of signal locality. Not exactly the epistemic constraint he considers, but it is an epistemic constraint. You can't know everything about the hidden variables, even if they are deterministic. And I think an interesting thing to think about is that both of these concepts depend fundamentally on this notion of an agent, of someone who can control things and observe things. And that was, for Bell, an objection to this concept of signal locality. But because local causality is violated, today we think that, maybe signal locality is really the expression of this relativistic prohibition. So having an agent there, introducing this notion of an agent, actually is useful and might lead us to new understandings, because after all, that's what we are. So yeah, I have some other discussions, but I think I'll be short of time. Is this still time? Okay, good. Don't make my clock's probably wrong.
want to carry on with those things.
Right, so just a little discussion here. I had to skip a bit on some of these things, but maybe it would be interesting to have a discussion. A common understanding of what the implications of Bell's theorem are is this, that Bell's theorem tells us to give up determinism and all hidden variables. But that's a misconception. The original theorem was about local determinism, and maybe that's why people thought that it was better to keep locality and reject determinism. But as I mentioned, violation of locality by a model does not imply violation of signal locality. So you might still have locality, that's fine, and still have determinism, that's what Bohmian mechanics does. And in fact, Bell's intention was to defend Bohmian mechanics against his objection that it was non-local and say that any hidden variable model that is deterministic must be non-local, or any hidden variable model, at first that is deterministic must be non-local, and later any hidden variable model must be non-locally causal, it must violate locality. So the desire to, and in fact, operational quantum mechanics violates local causality. If you define local causality as just being that the probabilities here do not depend on events over there, then in operational quantum mechanics they do. And so it violates local causality. So just a desire to keep local causality cannot be a motivation to reject determinism of hidden variables. And then the other question, as I mentioned, is if the hidden variables exist, why can't we know about them? And one answer that I try to give here is that no phenomenon that allows violations of Bell inequalities can be predictable. You can't know about hidden variables, even if they are deterministic. And there may be other reasons to consider hidden variable models, because it maybe helps you solve the measurement problem. You can apply it to cosmology, and you can have an ignorance interpretation of probabilities. Whether or not you like hidden variable models, that's another question, but I think these points are interesting to be made. And another one, which I just like, this is very sort of just putting here to ventilate his ideas and see what his opinions are. What does it mean to violate realism? That's what I want to try to ask. And I really don't have an answer, just try to sort of give you my opinions of what this could possibly mean. Some people say that, well, Bell inequalities tell us to give up realism. What does realism mean? If you mean by realism just hidden variables, then I would give you the last answer and say, well, giving up hidden variables doesn't save local causality, so that's not good enough an answer. So if you give up what we defined by realism, which was this conjunction of these axioms of reality and space-time, you can't save local causality either, because you can't even define it. Well, how do you define local causality if you don't have this basic structure set up? So to say that I'm giving up realism because of Bell's theorem, because I can't understand, it's not because you want to keep local causality. You may have some other reasons for that, and maybe that's one thing. If any of you have this idea, what are the reasons you have for that? And that's one thing I try to understand. If you just mean hidden variables, then okay, then that's something else. But if you mean something like this, rejecting these two axioms, then what does it mean to reject that? To reject the second axiom, the space-time, would maybe mean something like this, that not all events happen in the same space-time, although they are some sort of ontologically separable. And maybe that's what many worlds tell, the picture of reality that many worlds gives us. And to reject the first axiom would mean something like this. The very existence of events are not absolute facts out there, independent of other systems or other observers. If you don't want to make a distinction between observers and systems, which is something I like what Robin was did in his talk, I like to think that way too. That observers and systems, observers are just not a system. So, very existence of events, if you reject this axiom of reality, just means that the very existence of these events are not absolute facts, independent of observers. Different observers may disagree about whether or not some event actually occurs. And maybe, I'm not sure, and that's maybe that's what relational quantum mechanics tries to do. And maybe that's what I understood by this new word I just learned, by Jamesian pragmatism, that Fuchs just told me. Do you think that's a good no, or maybe not that you go
at. Spell checker is very smart because I would spell that with an I.
Good, good. Yeah. But do you think it's fair to say
that? I don't want to comment beyond that.
No, okay, good. Very good. All right, so with this, I thank you very much.
Okay, so, Hugh?
Eric, as you set things up, do you assume that the no reciprocality?
Yes, of course.
But what's interesting about that, I think, given that one of your main conclusions was the fundamental nature of no predictability.
Yes.
My guess is that if you threw out that axiom, you still wouldn't get predictability because the kind of hidden.
If you threw out which axiom?
The no reciprocality axiom.
Right, you would still get.
The kind of hidden variables we start throwing that out would allow you to put in would have to be fundamentally sort of inaccessible ones.
Yes. Yes.
And so it wouldn't have any influence on predictability.
I think I agree from Clinton, try to do that, but yeah.
Yeah, if that's yes, right, yep. Then there's a more general version of your result. It doesn't depend on that.
Yes.
There will be a more general version of the result.
But that is the more general version that Eric was talking about. Because we don't, it's not assuming local causality, it's only assuming single locality.
Yes. Yeah. No, I think what he's saying is that the ontological model itself assumes that hidden variables don't depend on choice of experiment in the future. But what he's saying is that if you relax his assumption, then you would still get to the same conclusion. I agree with what he's saying.
Yeah, I think you still wouldn't get predictability.
Yeah, exactly. If you value Bell and Quartz, you would still kind of get predictability. Yeah.
Rob?
So I'm curious if you can confirm something for me that what you're talking about is the thing that powers security against post-quantum adversaries that we talk about, for example, Barrett, Hardy, and Kent, right? Bitcoin. Suppose you have a theory which is simply no signaling, but you can imagine that there might, you know, be an eavesdropper who can do things beyond quantum mechanics.
Yeah.
So Alice and Bob only know quantum mechanics. They have their labs floating in space, and you imagine the eavesdropper has control over everything else in the universe. And so the concern would be if the eavesdropper can know the hidden variables, for example, then eavesdropper can predict everything that's going to happen in Alice and Bob's lab, and any attempt that they have to set up correlations will fail because the eavesdropper will know them.
Right.
And it seems to me that when you say, imagine you knew the hidden variables, the very fact that you have Bell inequality violations...
Exactly. If you knew the hidden variables, you wouldn't have Bell inequality violations, and so...
Right. And so am I right in thinking that this is what powers the post-quantum cryptography, or maybe you haven't thought about
it? No, I haven't thought about it at all.
Okay.
I think what I'm saying makes sense.
Yeah.
I think you're right.
Things, yeah. I'm sorry.
Yeah. I think you're right. I had that thought during the talk.
Yeah.
About that.
Yeah.
You might want to chat with Adrian Kent at some point because he's been telling me about very similar ideas he has about driving on predictability from Bellian body violations.
Right, cool.
I don't know if he published it.
No, we don't.
When we were talking about relativity and unpredictability and being a good conclusion for the Bohmians. Let me see if this is what you mean. Yeah, you say the validity of relativity means relativity is valid at the phenomenological level. The phenomena are relativistic, and when you say this. There's no signal locality is the essence of relativity. That is something that's a statement that's dependent on our structure as agents, observers,
yeah.
what we actually
right.
can do
uh-huh.
and what we can't do.
Yeah.
You're rejecting the idea that relativity means there's no preferred frame. So this is good for the Bohmians because in Bohmian.
I'm not rejecting the idea.
You have a preferred frame, but
yes.
If you are in equilibrium, you get relativistic phenomena.
Yeah,
that's what you're saying.
Yeah, well, I'm not necessarily rejecting that idea. I'm just sort of, if you consider that idea, then that's the conclusion you get. Or even if you say, even if you maybe consider that there might be, maybe local causality should be really the expression of relativity, that would just mean that you're saying that relativity is false, because local causality is false. You could still think that signal locality is a stronger concept anyway, because signal locality leads you to a paradox, clearly, and violation of local causality does. So I'm not trying to say that I want to tell you to tell you that that is what relativity says, but definitely relativity says that that is a very strong thing to consider.
I'm actually not sure that violation of signal locality would lead you to paradoxes, because you are assuming, if signal locality is violated, then maybe
you need to assume invariance.
Yeah.
You need to assume relativity invariance, because then you say there's no preferred frame for these boxes, just transfer the signal, so you can have one, make all the loop, yes. So if you don't assume relativity, then signal locality is fine. Violation of signal locality presumably could be fine. But if you do assume relativistic invariance, then it's a problem.
Any more questions? No. So let's thank everybody. Speaker is Steve Jones, who's going to address steering witnesses and criteria for the non-existence of local interstates and models.
Thanks. So when I presented the abstract for this conference, I wasn't expecting to have a 55-minute talk, so this talk might be a little bit short, and we might just get to lunch a bit early. But if there's ongoing questions from people, I'd be happy to talk more with people over lunch about this work. So actually, some of this work was spoken about by Howard and Eric, both at Steve Bartlett's Kudji workshop a bit over a week ago. And there was a little bit of controversy over mainly our use of terminology. So hopefully today I'll be able to reiterate that and add a little more weight to why we think our generalization of Schrodinger's term steering is a good one. And that also led me to go through a little disclaimer at the start. So one of the main points that people brought up was that they like to use steering as an argument for the epistemic view of quantum states. And before that, I hadn't honestly thought about that too much myself. So I'm not going to try and address this problem during this talk, but if people are interested in this idea, I'm more than happy to talk about this more. So yeah, this was basically the argument that people put forth when they said this. They said this is what they think that Schrodinger meant. So I'm not 100% convinced about some of those arguments. So I'll try and give you some flavour for why I think that. And this is just a random one which I just sort of thought of last night, that I haven't thought too much about the idea of contextuality for hidden variables. So I haven't thought about that in the context of this. But if anyone knows more than I about that and wants to talk, then I'm quite happy to talk at lunch. So what I actually will talk about, this is a Foundations conference, and we've heard from a lot of people about the EPR paradox and arguments coming from the early days of quantum mechanics. And I believe that, as we heard yesterday, that thinking about what the strange things are in the theory of quantum mechanics, the paradoxes, can give us some insight into what we should think about to improve the theory or to move forward. And so I'll give some history for where this work comes from and our definitions. And then I'll move into something that's slightly more experimental in terms of actually doing physics and trying to come up with predictions that can be tested in a lab and see what that says about whether these phenomena occur and what they actually show. I'll give it like a brief discussion of loopholes, because obviously if we say we've got some experiment and it exhibits some phenomena, if we haven't closed the loopholes, then it's arguable about whether you can sort of justify the claims that you want to make about what these phenomena show. And I'll give a quick example of a steering criteria that we've come up with towards the end, and I'll list some open problems which people may want to talk to me more about. So we saw a very similar slide to this in Eric's talk, and we've heard from many people at the conference about this seminal work from Einstein, Podolsky and Rosen way back in 1935, and obviously we're still talking about it, so we haven't resolved all of the problems with the paradox they came up with. And before talking about the example that EPR used, so it's important to list the assumptions that go into their viewpoint. And in particular, they start off with like a necessary condition for completeness. And by that, they say that every element of the physical reality must have a counterpart in the physical theory, which obviously then leads to, well, what do you think about reality? And basically, you can sum up their condition for reality is that if you can accurately predict a physical quantity or the value of a physical quantity, then there must be some element of reality that is associated with it. And the final, perhaps, big assumption that goes into particularly Einstein's thinking is this idea of local causality, that you can't have any action at a distance. And then they go on to consider a general non-factorizable state that can be expressed in the following form, where you've got some weightings, and this is some orthonormal basis for the first subsystem, say Alice's subsystem, and this is some orthonormal basis for the second subsystem, say Bob's subsystem. And we can decompose this state in different ways. We can use some different coefficients and two different sets of orthonormal bases for Alice and Bob, and it's an equally valid description of the state. So then, assuming that we've got the state psi that was on the previous slide, then they go away, and you can send half off to Alice and half to Bob. And then for certain states, like the states on the previous slide, if you make the maximally entangled states, then if you make a measurement of the position operator at Alice's side, then you'll get some outcome, and that will allow you to infer the outcome that Bob would obtain for his position measurement. And similarly, if Alice measures momentum, then you can infer the momentum at Bob's side. So since these measurements today allow you to predict with certainty either XB or PB, then there must be elements of reality for both of these things. But obviously, quantum mechanics doesn't allow prediction simultaneously of the position of momentum at Bob's system. So then, since EPR really believed those original assumptions on the previous page, so they couldn't see how you could reject any of those assumptions, they thought, well, clearly then, the conclusion is that quantum mechanics must be incomplete. This has obviously prompted a lot of work, in particular, right when it was first published in the same year, Schrödinger became interested in the same idea. And he introduced I'm correct in saying that in his English paper in Proceedings of the Cambridge Philosophical Society, paper in 1935, was when he first used the terms entangled for the type of state that Einstein, Podolsky and Rosen described. And he also used the term steering to describe this apparent effect that you could exhibit using this type of entangled state. And when Einstein first used the term, he said that you have these two systems that interact in the past, and by the interaction, the two representatives or the wave functions become entangled. And then furthermore, he goes on to say, shortly after this in this same paper, that what constitutes the entanglement is that psi is not a product of a function for x and a function for y, or in the example I gave on the previous slide, not a function of x and a function of p. So what he found problematic about something you could show with entanglement was that it's rather discomforting that the theory of quantum mechanics should allow a system to be steered, which is where we adopt this terminology steering, or piloted into one or the other type of state at the experimenter's mercy in spite of his having or her having no access to it. So this is what he found was quite strange. I mean, he emphasised in the paradox and his steering in general that this choice of measurement is an important feature. I mean, because Alice can do measurements, and the state arrived at one side, say Bob's side, depends quite decidedly on what measurements one chooses to take at Alice's side, not only on the results. So we say that Alice can steer Bob's state if she can prepare different ensembles of states for Bob by performing, and it becomes important that there's at least two different types of measurements on her system. And Some people then argue that, as I said in the start, that Schrödinger was going for, also arguing for incompleteness, because he was considering EPR's paradox, and that's an argument for incompleteness. But I believe that Schrödinger actually, from what he wrote, and he coming up with the wave function, he thought it was correct for the local system at one of the party's sides. But he wasn't sure that once you separated the two systems, whether they would remain so closely, in some classical sense, correlated, or some so closely connected, in some sense, that you would actually be able to observe these correlations. So he thought that once you separated the two, maybe quantum mechanics didn't give you an accurate description of what was happening over the second side any longer. So his argument for steering perhaps was an argument for incorrectness, not necessarily incompleteness. And I believe that he would have been very surprised to see experimental evidence for steering or for entanglement or for violation of Abelian equality, because he didn't believe that those correlations would actually exist in nature. So both those examples I've talked about only consider pure states from these 1935 works. And you can show for pure states that entanglement is basically equivalent to being steerable, because any pure entangled state can exhibit this phenomena of steering. And equally, that's the same as being able to demonstrate violation of Abelian equality, which I'll talk a bit more about later. But even with modern experiments where we have substantial improvements in techniques, we still have to deal with mixed states in the laboratory. So you might wonder, well, how does this generalize? And so the original EPR paradox was generalized, I think, in 1989 by Margaret Reed. And the way she did it was to go back to EPR's original assumptions and to modify those to allow for imperfect correlations that result as a consequence of mixed states. And so what she defined was like these fuzzy elements of reality instead of an element of reality associated with a phenomena or a measurement. And then she would ask about when Alice could infer these elements of reality of Bob's side, and when the inferred variances of those predictions would then violate an uncertainty principle. And when that was the case, then she would say that you've demonstrated the EPR criteria. So that's what is called, I guess, now the EPR Reed criteria. And then you can say, well, we've got Schrödinger's idea of steering, which is for pure states. And in this recent paper, which Eric alluded to in his talk, that I worked on with Howard and Andrew Doherty, we've tried to generalize for mixed states a definition that you could use to explain steering for mixed states as well. So because this isn't a quantum information talk, usually I would give a operational definition in terms of some sort of quantum information task, but because we're not all quantum information theorists here, I'll go to a mathematical definition that people usually like to see straight afterwards anyway. And I'll start with the idea of separability. And this is I'm using similar notation to what Eric used in his previous talk, so hopefully everyone will be able to follow. So we say the state is separable if there is a local hidden state model for both of the parties in the experiment, for a bipartite state. So that means that the probabilities, if Alice makes measurement little a and Bob makes the measurement little b, and there's some preparation procedure described by C, then the probability of getting the outcome A for Alice and big B for Bob is this average over these possibly hidden variables of the probability is factorized, so we get probability for Alice's system with a subscript Q denoting that this is a quantum probability derived from there being a quantum state for Alice's system, and similarly that there's a probability consistent with Bob having a quantum system at his site. Then you might say, well, this looks similar to what you might call Bell locality in these local hidden variable models. So for Bell locality, we say that a state is Bell local or won't violate Abelian equality if there's a local hidden variable model for both parties. So it's very similar to the above expression, but now we've dropped these Qs, and now this is just any probability distribution over the hidden variables for these outcomes. And then if this doesn't hold, then the state of interest violates Abelian equality, and if this doesn't hold, then the state of interest is entangled or non-separable. And then we fit it with what we call steerability or non-steerability, that fits right in the middle. That we have now a local hidden state model for one party. and I choose Bob for that party. And so the joint probability, if it takes this form, then we say that a state which has these probabilities is not steerable. And if this is violated, then we get the state that is steerable. And it's been argued that perhaps this isn't a very appealing model from a foundational standpoint, because I mean, if you believe that quantum mechanics works on one side, sort of why would you not consider quantum mechanics on the other side? If you're going to consider this, why wouldn't you just consider this one? And if you thought, well, I don't want to assume quantum mechanics, I just want to assume this one, then why wouldn't you assume and jump to this one? But I would argue that the way that the arguments from EPR and Schrödinger were formulated, they explicitly thought about this asymmetric idea that they talked about one party affecting the other side, not the fact. So that's not constraining what happens on the one side. It's only constraining that the quantum states on the other side are the things that are getting affected, the things that become important. So as Eric said, this is just leaving it unconstrained for Alice. So as a result of whatever Alice can do, whether that's described by quantum theory or something more general, can that influence the quantum states we imagine at Bob's side? And if that is the case, then this equality won't hold, and we'll have what we call a steerable state. So you might say, well, why do we want to consider these experimental criteria? So putting aside the possible foundational arguments for a moment, well, as Eric pointed out, demonstration of the EPR effect or steering is actually a demonstration that potentially local causality is false, or the system at Bob's side can't be described by a quantum state. Also, you could say quantum mechanics would be incomplete. Another idea is potentially easier to get around detection loophole than in Bell inequality experiments. And hopefully one of the main motivations we've got for this work is actually we expect that this concept will have some applications in quantum information theory, whereas some people are starting to talk about considering quantum applications at one side and leaving things general on the other side, and that sort of seems analogous to what we're trying to do here with states. So this immediately leads to two types of problems that you might want to consider. The first one is what we call experimental steering. And this is, given a set of measurements for the two parties and a preparation procedure, can the outcomes that we get from this experiment demonstrate steering? That is, do they violate this assumption that Bob has a local hidden state model at his side? And with just a definition of terminology, we say that any sufficient criterion for experimental steering will be called a steering criterion. Then you could ask the other type of question, which is something that we address primarily in the PRL work, is a very state-dependent type of question. We ask about state steerability. Given a quantum state, can you use it to demonstrate steering with some measurements performed by Alice and Bob? And for this task, we'll call any sufficient criterion a steerability witness. It's not necessarily obvious that the two questions are isomorphic. Before I talk about this concept of witnesses a bit more, I just have a quick review of the idea of an entangable witness. I think it's developed by the Horodeckis. And they say that a bipartite density matrix in a Hilbert space is entangled if and only if there's some Hermitian operator H such that trace of H rho is negative and trace of H sigma is greater than or equal to zero for all separable density matrices. And the argument behind the proof of this is basically that there exists a plane separating a convex set, which is the set of separable states, and a point outside the entangled state. And basically then the Hermitian operator H defines that separating plane between the set and the point. And the same can be true for any convex set, e.g. non-steerable states. So you might think, well, okay, we can define a similar lemma that a bipartite density matrix on Hilbert space is steerable if and only if there's a Hermitian operator which I'll call S such that trace of S rho is negative and trace of S sigma is greater than or equal to zero for all non-steerable density matrices. And this leads us to a subtle point which I only just recently talked to Eric and Howard about, that not necessarily is it the case that the measurements that you need to determine this quantity does it necessarily follow that it violates a local hidden state model. And this led us to introduce the term Bell non-locality witness, which is sort of be an operator similarly of this form, some operator that you could you could find its expectation value with some state, a particular state, and see if that allowed you to predict whether it would that state would violate a Bell-Inner quality, as opposed to whether the correlations necessarily violate a local invariable model. And there's this example, which I'm not writing it down, might be a bit hard to follow, but if you have a Bell singlet state, you know that violates a Bell inequality. So then you might say, well, if I have an operator which projects onto the Bell singlet state minus some constant times the identity, then that could show you that the state necessarily violates Bell inequality, because if it's close enough in some sense to being a Bell state, then you'll know it's going to violate the CHSH inequality definitely. But the particular measurements that you might need to evaluate this projector onto the singlet minus this constant identity could have a local hidden variable model. So while you've got an operator that shows you the state violates Bell inequality, those particular measurements don't necessarily violate a local hidden variable model. So that's the distinction. And similarly, I haven't got an example for the steerability case yet, but we expect that similarly you could have this distinction between the two sets. So that leads us to this table. Whereas for entanglement witnesses, if a state has an entangled witness, then we expect that this is also equivalent to a separability criterion for the correlations. But then for steering, and we're talking about state steerability, we have a steerability witness defined, as I did in the previous page, and then that's equivalent to an EPR criterion, or not necessarily, or a steering criterion if we're talking about the correlations that we get out of the experiment. This is the type of criterion that we'd want to consider. And simply for Bell non-locality, for the correlations, we talk about a Bell inequality, and people talk about the sort of Bell operator, but you could talk about it sort of more generally, call this like a Bell non-locality witness, the operator that shows you that you have a particular state which violates a Bell inequality. And so the distinction, we've got these red terms, are sort of the new terms which we sort of promote, and with the difference being, as I said, the witnesses are on the space of states, and the experimental criteria are related to the space of the correlations. So as we all know, if we've got a Bell inequality, it's an experimental criterion that you derive from the existence of a local hidden variable model. And if you violate that inequality, then you can say that this implies the failure of local hidden variable theories. And analogously, you can define experimental steering criteria by deriving these conditions based on the existence that there's this local hidden state model for Bob's system, and which is equivalent to the probabilities being consistent with this. So if you derive a condition such that this is satisfied, and then you violate it with experimental correlations, say, then you can say that violation implies that you've shown steering. However, as I mentioned earlier, for Bell inequality tests, we've got these loopholes, like the detection and locality loopholes, and people like to appeal to these experiments and say, okay, so we know for certain now that there's no possible way we could have a local invariable model which describes what we see in a lab. But then other people could argue, well, if you haven't closed both the loopholes, perhaps you could come up with some crazy local invariable theory that exploits this in some sort of conspiratorial fashion and gets you out of trouble. So you might think, well, do these experimental criteria that I'm developing for steering, are they affected by loopholes? And if it's easier to show a loophole-free test of steering, then I guess that might be like an interesting stepping stone towards getting loophole-free tests of Bell inequalities, which would be very exciting. So for the locality loophole, initially to me it wasn't obvious that it would apply to this asymmetric steering with Alice doing something on one side and then affecting Bob's on the other side. But then I thought about it a bit more. To be rigorous, we think you should assume that once Bob's obtained his system, whether Alice sent it to it, like in our quantum information perspective, we imagine Alice preparing the entangled state and sending part to Bob. So once Bob obtains his part of the system, then we've got to assume that Alice can't affect it any longer or affect any of the outcomes of the detectors that Bob's got. And if that holds, then the locality loophole will be closed. And then the detection loophole, well, this is something you would expect would affect steering. I mean, for Bob's side, it's perhaps not so important, because the key point for him is he's got to be able to perform sufficient measurements to do tomographically complete measurements to determine what state he's got, so he can compare it with what he hears from Alice to see if he believes that his state actually has been steered to a certain ensemble by Alice's measurements. However, if Alice has inefficient detectors, this is going to be a problem, because then it's going to be harder for her to steer to a given ensemble. Sometimes she's going to make measurements and not get what she thinks, or not get the right outcome. So the state that Bob's going to be steered to might be different to what Alice expects it to be. So he's going to do a tomographically complete measurement and find out that he gets some inconsistency with what Alice has said. And he's not necessarily going to believe that this steering actually even has occurred. So you might expect that in the case of Bell inequalities, there's some threshold detection efficiency that you need to be above to sort of close the loophole. And there'll be a similar type of threshold, perhaps lower, for demonstrating steering. So yeah, so we expect that this general it would be lower and easier to show steering. So I'll just give an example. So most people, I guess, would possibly be familiar with the Werner state, where this is a maximally entangled singlet state of 2 qubits. This is the identity over 2 qubits. And we've got some state which is some fraction, singlet, and 1 minus that, maximally mixed. And if you assume a local hidden state model for just Bob's system, then you can show, if people are interested, I can talk about them later about the details of this, that you can get a criteria of the following form on the correlations. So it's a steering criteria that must be satisfied. Where these are operators on Alice's system, obviously these are operators on Bob's system. Here we've got this number of measurement settings that have to be performed. As I alluded earlier, it has to be greater than 2, because if there's only 1 measurement setting, then it's never clear that Alice can affect the state of Bob's system. I mean, there might be just some ensemble of states. There will always be a local state, might be some ensemble, and Alice's measurement might just pick a different one, and there's nothing crazy about that. But if there's 2 measurement settings, and there's 2 different ensembles, and if the elements of the ensembles are different, then there appears to be some influence that Alice's measurements are having, so we need this to be at least 2. And this constant just is dependent on the particular number of measurements, and assuming this local hidden state for Bob. And for n equals 2, say we have, we consider a projective measurement, say sigma x and sigma y, then you can show that this inequality will be violated for this state when this eta parameter is greater than 1 and root 2, which is 0.707. And you might be thinking, well, I know about Werner states, and I know that you can violate a Bell inequality with a Werner state for eta greater than 1 or root 2, so where's the difference? And then you can go away and say, well, I need a better steering criteria, and you can use the 3 measurement version of this. And for n equals 3, this condition for this to be violated actually drops to 1 and root 3, which is about 0.57, which is quite a drop and quite a bit easier you'd expect to demonstrate. And you might be thinking, oh, this looks great. I'll make this 4, this will drop to 1 and root 4, which is a half, and we can keep just getting lower and lower and lower. However, unfortunately, we've got a proof in general for this type of state, and shown that asymptotically, as you make this like sort of an infinite number of many settings, this actually would asymptote for the Werner states down to a half. So it doesn't follow this simple sort of 1 over root n relation that you might expect. But still, this is sort of encouraging that you can show steering with relatively few measurements, and it should be easier in an experiment to show in sort of some sort of loophole-free way than you might expect with a Bell inequality. So there's still some summary and still some open problems. So we think that this local hidden state model for one party is the correct way to formalize the concept of steering that Schrodinger talked about. Is this, because they spoke about it more as a phenomena that you could see with an entangled state, but then it was not obvious. I mean, when you get to mixed states, violating a Bell inequality is a phenomena that you might see for some entangled states, but not all. So it's not obvious that all entangled states should necessarily, even though for pure states they do. So similarly with steering, it's not obvious that while pure states are all steerable if they're entangled, it's not obvious that the mixed states they should be. So we argue that this is the correct way you should generalize the concept of steering. I've just briefly introduced this concept of witnesses and steering criteria as some sort of experimental test to see if you've got this phenomena. Then there are still a lot of open questions to do with this. I mean, there's all these open questions to do with Bell inequalities, and similarly we have open questions with this about, can we have an algorithm to generate all of the possible steering criteria that you might want? Because we might be able to find one and say, okay, we know that this is a local hidden state, this has to hold, but there might be better criteria that might make it easier in experiments. And then we also, what are the set of all of the state-dependent questions? What are all the steerable states? In particular, sort of wondering about, this is an asymmetric concept. In all the examples that we've considered, we've looked at symmetric entangled states. So either Alice could steer Bob or Bob could steer Alice equally well. But potentially there could be some sort of asymmetric entangled state where you could steer one way but not the other, and that might be interesting for some tasks. just a quick point, maybe generalizing this idea of Bell non-locality witnesses in some sort of formal way might help in studying sets of Bell local states, perhaps. And this is sort of the big one for the concept of steering, which we think that hopefully there will be useful applications for this idea, which is, I guess, what we try to do. We go from foundations to improve our theories and then use that for better predictions and better tasks in a laboratory. And then an interesting point also for improving the theories is what features of potential toy models allow steering in general. I mean, we heard from Rob yesterday about steering his toy model. So, I mean, it'd be interesting to find out what the actual features are that point to why you can steer. And that could promote future research as well. So I think that's all I've got, if there are any questions. Yeah.
This is a question purposely for Rob, but in fact,
okay.
About steering as you talk about it and steering in toy models. As I understood the condition of non-steerability intuitively, it means, well, you don't have steering if you have that condition. Why? Because, well, really, what Bob has had is local hidden states that isn't affected by what Alice does.
Yeah.
Although, you know, it may appear at the quantum level to be spooky, it isn't. Hidden state is local, nothing has happened to it. Okay, so this is non-steerability. I thought what Rob was talking about, but was talking about steering in toy models, was what corresponds to the apparent steering in the situation. So Alice does something, and the apparent quantum state on Bob's side is affected, while in fact the hidden state isn't. And I thought that was what Rob was talking about in the toy model, that what corresponds to the side epistemic quantum state is steered, while the ontic state isn't. So I think you're talking.
Yeah, this is the arguments or discussions we were having at Coogee about our two uses of the term and how they overlap and what you're trying to use the concept of steering for. If you're trying to use it to promote this epistemic view, then you think that nothing crazy is going on because it's just updating your knowledge about the real ontic state. And then this is, I guess, the trap I sometimes fall into, thinking about these things always as ontic states, even if I'm just doing it naively, that you expect that it is strange if the quantum state, if you think of it as an ontic thing over here, does actually change. Whereas in Rob's, well, it sort of never seems too mysterious because you're just always updating your information. So we formalized it in the sense that I'm not sure that it depends. I guess your interpretation of it will depend on how strange you find the concept or not. But I want to talk to Rob more about that after this to see if we can come to some common ground on how we want to use the term in some sort of consistent fashion, if we could.
Do you want to comment, Rob?
I don't think our disagreement has necessarily that much to do with this issue, but perhaps I'm wrong. I think what you said was right, that one could say, so you weren't talking about the relevance to the psi-ontic-psi epistemic distinction, but what you could say is that if you believe in a psi-ontic view of invariables, then perhaps like Schrodinger, you will look at steering and you'll say, that's evidence of non-locality because distant reality.
Sorry, you mean a scientific view of quantum state?
Yeah.
Is that what you meant? You did
sorry.
Say
what did I say?
You said a scientific view of invariables.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. But if you believe that psi is ontic,
okay.
yeah, then you'll look at any evidence for steering and say, that's evidence for non-locality. But if you think that psi is epistemic, then you will look at evidence for steering and say, I'm still not convinced that there's anything all over going on because I think it's just affecting my knowledge.
So I guess in that sense, this work does promote foundational discussion.
Yes, but then, that's why I was trying to say that then that's not enough because they also says that you can't be locally. So the
violation of steering, it still allows you to forget that, well, they're standing. And that's still, from, I say, locality, but I don't know what they say, they're standing. But Bell's theorem says that, that you can't say locality.
Right, so, so it's not a question of stating locality, but the question is, what's the sort of easiest experiment you can do to demonstrate on locality? If you're, you believe in the science you do, then there's much easier experiments, like experiments demonstrating steering. That will turn into a non locality. If you live inside of the same view, these cards are right.
Excuse me. Okay.
Any more questions?
Well, I guess just a comment at the meeting I was at in Japan last week. Peter Drummond and Margaret Reed both had talks, and they were actually talking about, to be sort of relevant to what Rob was talking about, something like. Unambiguous non-separability or unambiguous entanglement or something. And so what they were talking about there was sort of like a loophole-free test of non-separability as well, which we've been talking about, you know, oh, well, yeah, I suppose that's another option you could think about. And so actually they've been working on that.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. And you know about that. Oh, you're in the street. You were an orphan. Right, okay. So. Okay.
Yeah, that was exactly what I was trying to say. But yeah, if you want to demonstrate local quality, you just want to demonstrate violation of the separate building.
Yeah.
But then if you want to do that, then you may draw less into a loophole.
Yeah. And that's more, I think, what our argument last week was about. It seems to me from a foundational perspective, if you believe in the synoptic view, then the experiments that you go do are tests of non-separability. And only if you have some strange asymmetric view and say, I believe that system B is quantum and system A is classical, would you then go do it, you know, say, oh, the non-separability test didn't convince me. I need the non-separability test to convince me. And so my point is that there's a set of people who might be convinced by the non-separability test, and a set of people that are going to hold out for the non-locality test. But I can't think of anyone who's going to hold out for the non-separability test.
Okay, but I think Steve still has a good point that in terms of motivating steps towards a full Bell non-locality test, a loophole-free Bell non-locality test, that it's nice to have something which is a definite threshold, which is not yet attained, as far as you know, but, well, actually I have to think about that, but anyway.
Okay, any more questions or comments?
Well, let's thank Steve.